Flashback? Flashback?
Rufio! Rufio!
Flashbacks.
All day I've had this strong desire raging from within. You can say that my heart's on fire.
Somewhere between.
Keep your hands on where I can see them, man.
Hey, it's 21st century, man. I don't know what I can do.
Flashbacks.
You are a sick individual and you need to be put out of your misery.
Flashback? Flashback?
Well, hello, everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to the Front Row Network's Flashbacks, a part of NPR Illinois' Community Voices, where we get all nostalgia-like about the movies of our past. Movies from the 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s that have shaped the way we think of cinema and pop culture today, and how those movies have given us insight and hope in our everyday lives. If you have ever had spectral-inspired cabin fever, and all that work and no play turned you into a homicidal doughboy that gets hammered on spirits, then you might be thinking of The Shining. It is Monster Cast, and we have a huge anniversary to celebrate, 40 years of The Shining. It is a huge episode. I can call this the mega crossover event because we've got not one, not two, but three podcasts on this particular episode. But before we get in all that, I am your host, Ryan Lutens, and with me as always is my partner in crime, Mr. Jay Hoffman.
How we doing?
We're doing good. We're doing good. How you doing, buddy?
Oh, man. I just watched Dr. Sleep yesterday and saw The Shining on the big screen, and I love this movie.
Oh, that's going to be great. Unfortunately, our co-host, Erin, she couldn't be with us. She got a call that she needed to go to Colorado for some odd reason. I don't know. We'll pray for her. hopefully there's
Thoughts and prayers.
So we had this idea, The Shining turned 40. We've been talking about this for a while. This is a flashback because it's celebrating 40th anniversary during MonsterCast, but it's also considered a horror classic. So what other way could we have celebrated as a classic than having our own classic host come on, Mr. Brandon Davis?
Hello, how's it going?
It's going. Thank you for joining us tonight.
No problem. This is a lot more intense than what I've talked about on my show this month. So.
you've done two this month, right? One with Steve and then your own?
Two on my show, and then I went on Steve's inaugural episode this month. So this is my fourth for the month.
Oh, well, we'll have four when we're done. We're all said and done. God, I love MonsterCast. Jeremy just gets so bold because he loves horror so much.
I know.
All right. Rounding out our panel of podcasts is we are very delighted to be hosting a fellow podcast, but they are calling in because they're a radio station. With us tonight, we have Derry Public Radio and their hosts, CM and Josh. How are you guys doing?
So great.
Good. How's everybody doing?
We're doing, man. This is awesome. So I don't want to spoil it while you guys are here. Why don't you guys tell us what Derry Public Radio is all about?
Derry Public Radio is a biweekly Stephen King book club podcast, and we do deep dives into Stephen King's work, and that includes sometimes the adaptation. So we do talk about movies when there is one. And I like to describe us as providing a range of perspectives anywhere from the comfortably familiar with Stephen King to frighteningly fanatic.
That's why you're here, because especially when it comes to perspective, and this film, because Stanley Kubrick is a nut job. And so we're just going to go right into it. So Jay, first off, thank you guys for being a part of this show tonight. Really excited that you guys were able to be on. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Yep.
All right, Jay, let's get into it. What is The Shining all about?
All right, the Torrance family decides to take a working vacation to the Overlook Hotel to make sure its shitty boiler system doesn't blow the building up over the winter season. Over the course of this extended holiday, Jack slowly begins to realize that his wife and psychic son are a real drag to his writing process. And after an intervention with a spectral spirit slinger, he gets back to his fun time drinking ways. As he gets back off the wagon, or on the wagon, or whichever one means you're drinking again, he decides to play whack-a-mole with an axe in his family's skulls. Unfortunately, his son is really good at bush maze hide-and-seek, and he and his mother escape as Jack Torrance freezes to death with a grimace that belongs to the ages.
Awesome. Man, I love your film synopsis. They are the best.
Wholly accurate. Not with it. No hyperbole.
Before we dive in, Brandon, I forgot something. I forgot. What? This is CM and Josh's first time on the Front Row show.
Yes.
We have to ask them something. All right, absolutely. Guys. We have to ask them. So before we break down facts for the movie, Josh, what is your favorite all-time movie that you will defend to your grave?
Clue.
Awesome. That's so cool.
Clue has been my favorite movie for like my whole life.
Well, make sure you check out our December episode where we are doing a Clue episode.
Game on.
What is going on? Everybody, like half of the Front Row Network's favorite movie is Clue.
What is That's happening? Because it's objectively a perfect movie.
Really, yeah.
It is smart, it's spooky, it's so well written, so well acted. There's not a single thing wrong with that movie.
Yeah, I just saw it for like the first time. A year ago? I don't know why. It just never made... I thoroughly enjoyed it. Well, my daughter just got into the game Clue. I'm like, hey, the movie's on sale. Let's check it out. And then I mentioned to the group, and then everyone's like, favorite movie? I'm like, what? Why? Everybody's doing...
All right, CM, what is your favorite movie that you will defend to the grave?
I have to follow that. Like, everybody agrees that it is their favorite.
It's not my favorite.
Okay. Well, you don't know this because you guys don't know me yet, but that's a very cruel question to ask me, to make me pick just one. And I've been giving this a lot of thought. And so I had to kind of work my way back. I had to think about who my favorite director is and why. And that's also really hard, but I love John Carpenter. I think he's a great director and a great composer. I just love the way everything he does sounds. It's so spooky and beautiful. And I also love Kurt Russell. So obviously The Thing is going to be very, very high up on my list. But if we're not focusing on horror, if we're like, okay, like any movie perhaps, a film that really got me recently is the 1976 film Network. It's a black comedy, satire, drama that is heartbreakingly still relevant today. And it's one of those movies that has this monologue that breaks you. You never forget it. But then I also really like the 1981, going back to horror, movie Possession. And if you haven't seen that, can I swear?
He said shitty boiler, so I don't see why not.
Holy fuck. That movie has a scene that will break your mind. So I guess Possession and also The Thing and Network and probably five others.
I have a rotating list of 10, so you're good.
You're all fine.
But John Carpenter, Ryan and I have talked. I think John Carpenter is like the patron saint of flashbacks for us. He's we talk a lot about John Carpenter on here.
Okay, so just for everyone playing the home game, we are a PG-13 episode, so our one F-bomb has been used, so we are done.
I'm so honored that I got to use that.
No, I can't say my favorite quote from the movie.
Just put a bleep where I say it.
All right, Brandon, let's break down The Shining. Give us the facts that made this movie so good.
All right. Well, I will try and do Aaron justice here.
I got to do a thing. She always does this. Fun facts. Okay, now you can.
Oh, okay. All right.
Wait, I thought you said she wasn't here.
I told her I'd do it for her.
She's shown to him.
She is in Colorado, after all.
This is Aaron, by the way, guys.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, this movie, as we all know, directed and written by Stanley Kubrick, starring Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, Danny Lloyd, and Scatman Crothers in the leads. Score by Wendy Carlos and Rachel Elkind. Budget of $19 million. That's an estimate. The opening weekend in May 26, 1980, $622,000. Don't you love inflation? And then the overall gross in the U.S., $45,332,000. And cumulative worldwide gross, $46 million. It's got a Rotten Tomato score currently of 84%. Kubrick signed on to the movie as long as he had complete control over the story. That's not a surprise. That happened with every movie. And Shining, interestingly enough, no Oscar nominations. It was nominated for 4 Saturn Awards, director, supporting actor, horror film, and best music. And Scatman Crothers won for best supporting actor. The Howling is what won for best horror movie that year. And then The Shining was also nominated for 2 Razzies, Worst Director for Stanley Kubrick and Worst Actress for Shelley Duvall. Didn't she suffer enough?
There's some real problems with the 1980s, and that's like top 4.
Hey, but, can we bring up the fact that Dick Tracy won 3 Academy Awards? I just want to go back to last month's episode.
However, though, time has been kind to it, because the American Film Institute in 2001 ranked at number 29 on the AFI's 100 Years, 100 Thrills list. Jack Torrance was number 25 on the Greatest Movie Villains list. Here's Johnny was number 68 on the top 100 movie quotes list. And in 2018, the Library of Congress added it to the National Film Registry.
All right, Brandon, thank you. So let's just do our dive. So first, we're going to take a look at the flashback portion. Jay and I will go last, but our Dairy Public Radio, what are your first memories of seeing this movie?
My first memory of seeing this movie was The Simpsons Treehouse of Horrors.
Ah, The Shining.
I saw that before I'd ever seen The Shining. And I was like, this is insane. And I asked my aunt, who was watching it with me, like, what this was. And she told me about The Shining, and then we watched it. And I didn't sleep for like a week. It was the woman in the bathtub haunted my nightmares for so long after I saw that movie.
All right, CM.
My dad let me watch a lot of 80s horror movies, and I was born in the 80s, so I was very, very young. And the ones that were too scary for me, and this was one of them, so he wisely did not let me watch it, I would sneak downstairs and kind of watch in the reflection of the door to the living room. We had like this glass door. And my first memory of The Shining, of course, what I walk in on is the twins. And I just got spooked and was like, yeah, I need to go to bed. That's it. I went to bed. Sometimes you're so scared, you just fall asleep.
Okay. I would just go to my bed and just be like, oh, God, there's 2 people looking at me. And they wouldn't leave me. All right, Brandon, what are your first memories when it comes to the Shining?
My first exposure to it was probably like, I think I walked in and my parents were watching it like on TNT or something, and I saw, and it was the Here's Johnny, it was the axe stuff that I saw for the first time, and I didn't stay and continue watching it. But then the first time I watched it all the way through was at a friend's house in high school. So and yeah, couldn't sleep that night because I'm a wimp, but but no, I've always been a Nicholson fan, so of course, you know, it's one of the one of the highlights of his filmography, and that's saying something.
Awesome. All right, Jay, what are your first memories when it comes to The Shining?
I gotta say, it's probably...
It wasn't last week, was it?
No, it wasn't last week. That was Dick Tracy. I did that for that episode. If only I could forget it. This movie, I love. It's great. High school, like Brandon, you know, I remember seeing clips and stuff, but never... The whole thing probably till high school when I started getting into cinema and experiencing some of the older movies and things like that. I have a different relationship with horror than Brandon. I genuinely It makes me feel more at ease watching horror movies. I don't feel unsettled going to bed, actually. Like, it freaks my wife out because that's when I want to watch it, is right before bed. Sleep nice and cozy, knowing I'm not there. I'm here, and this is much, no matter how crappy it is here, it's not there. But I remember, yeah, thoroughly enjoying it at the time. I think it's one of those movies I've liked more as I've gotten older. I think there were some things in it too for me with first time I was a little confused about, which I think I'll get into, because I think that was sort of Kubrick's intention, is to make you question things and the ambiguity. But when you're in high school, you don't really necessarily like, what the hell's the deal with that dude that's talking to him in the bathroom? You know, you're not doing the math on everything. You're just kind of taking it in, because all you've heard from your parents is how scary The Shining is forever and ever. And I agree. I think it is a very intense, very tense music. I think it's a very visually and audio wise, a thrill to the senses. And that's the thing that stands out to me. But I will say, cause I did see it last weekend on the big screen in the theater. Want to riff off what CM said about being a young child. Fun time story. So we're in there. There's about six people, and this lady walks in with what I'm pretty sure are her 4-ish and 6-year-old children. But the best part is this guy who just like is like, he's like what you imagine like a horror nerd looks like, man. Like, you know what I mean? He's like all about seeing The Shining on the big screen. He turns around and looks at all of us. He goes, am I in the right theater? I thought this was The Shining. And we're like, yep, it's The Shining. And very naively, but it came across very passive aggressively. He goes, oh, I saw the little kids and I thought we were in the wrong theater. Cause you know.
Are you sure it wasn't Larry? Are you sure it wasn't Larry?
It was not Larry. This guy had long hair, long flowing hair. And man, that guy made that situation so much funnier. But any time now that I question my parenting, I'll just flash back to that.
Yeah.
And feel a lot better about any of the questionable parenting choices I make. So now I've been ragging on. What about you, Ryan?
Okay. So Brandon, I'm glad you brought up TNT, because whenever I think of The Shining, I think of TNT. Am I the only one that does that? Like was TNT, did they show The Shining a lot?
I don't remember ever seeing it on there.
I don't think I've ever seen it on TNT.
It's owned by Warner Brothers. And so the TNT was a Turner. So yeah, it would have aired around that time a lot.
But. Okay. Okay. Cause like, I think back on the time when just when like AMC Fright Fest or they never showed this movie. Never. Uh-huh. And so, you know, my first real time with it was seeing it on TNT, and, you know, being, you know, starting to understand what movies are, you know, I just loved horror. You know, I didn't really give it a second thought because I thought it was filmed very differently. And as I grow up, I understand who directed it and what type of nut job that guy is. But we'll talk about that. So I just watched like, you know, the very edited version of it. And it really, I just watched like the tail end. I vividly remember walking in during the staircase scene. Give me the bat, give me the bat, bat, bat. Always sticks out to me. So my first like real sit down was in high school. I have a friend who was big into Stanley Kubrick, and I'm like, all right, let's give this a shot. And he told me, he goes, this guy is, he does things differently. And now knowing what I know, I fully understand that. But I remember watching it and being like, this is a near perfect movie. There's a lot of things that work. But then when you see and you come to terms with how the movie was made, you look at it a different lens. So that first viewing that I got was like, I was like, okay, I appreciate this movie and I see why people talk about it. But then you understand Kubrick and how he directs, and then you look at it a different way. And then when you see that there's so many different conspiracy theories, watch Room 237, so many out there. You can always watch this movie and it's like the first time you're viewing it. So that's one thing that I really, really like about this movie, because there's just so many layers to it. But High School was the very first time I was introduced. I thought it was good. I don't scare easily. My mom had us grow up watching Halloween, John Carpenter. So yeah, it was just, you know, I just thought, okay, this is a good movie. But what I like is that how every time you watch it, there's, you can watch it from a different angle. So, okay, enough with the flashback stuff. Let's talk about the movie as a whole. You know, this movie is considered a classic, in the sense that it's a horror classic. You know, Stanley Kubrick, while nutty, he does put out good movies. But let's just talk the movie as a whole. Let's talk about why it's a classic. What I am going to ask is that we kind of stay clear of the scripts, because we'll get to that with our friends from Dairy Public Radio. But let's just talk about things that we like. Brandon, you're the classic host. Let's start with you.
Well, I think the reason it's such a big classic is it was probably, even though I mentioned, you know, the Razzie love that it got, it really did in 1980. I think what Psycho did in 1960, 20 years before, it really sort of brought the horror genre up to a more serious level in terms of the industry. And I think it took a director like Kubrick and an actor like Nicholson to really sort of bring that about. But yeah, it's shot beautifully. It's got amazing performances. And it's unlike any horror movie, especially made up to that time. I think all the different time cuts and all of the different, you know, shots and how you can go forever without dialogue and stuff. It really is a movie unto itself. And I think that that's why it's so important.
All right, so you brought out the way it was shot and the way, the acting. Let's just talk acting. I'm sure that's what everyone's got on their mind. You know, this movie has four main actors. It's got Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, Daniel Lloyd, and then Scatman Crothers. These four guys are just nothing short of phenomenal. You know, and the fact that in the 80s, Shelley Duvall was nominated for a Razzie, and then people have gone back and said it's probably the best performance of her career. I totally agree with that. But yeah, let's talk acting. Dairy Public Radio, what do you guys think?
It is one of the most iconic performances from Jack Nicholson. We kind of touched on that earlier, like a career that has so many amazing moments and amazing roles. People will always go back to his portrayal of Jack Torrance. Because there's something so patient about this movie that you get to just embrace his descent into madness, and you can see him go through, you see his emotional range go from trying to get it together to fighting his way to not slip into madness, and then slipping into madness but thinking it's the right move. It's the right call for the time. That's something that makes it so unlike, especially modern horror, that it takes its time and you get to see him play that whole thing out. And I think it's amazing. I think Jack Nicholson crushes it.
I completely agree with that. And Shelley Duvall's performance obviously is amazing. And it's nice to be able to say that, because there is just that moment of disappointment when you realize her character is not quite that strong female character that we have in the book. But if you're going to deviate from that, I mean, do it explosively, really make it memorable. And she definitely did that. And then, of course, we do not have a Kenny, which I love. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that term, if you like Godzilla movies, but, you know, child actors can be interesting, and he does an amazing job. It's everybody sucks you into their performance so beautifully.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Jay, what do you think about when it comes to the performances in this movie?
I like what he said about Jack Nicholson, you know, watching him go into that descent. But what I like too is he has kind of the crazy sprinkled just a little bit in, even from the beginning. Even when he's talking with Mr. Ullman about getting the job, you can kind of see he's like, he's forcing this professional posturing and smiling. And, you know, you can already like right at the beginning, with just some of his facial features and how he kind of contorts his smile a little bit when Mr. Ullman's talking. Mr. Ullman's very charming and just not ever lacking in words, and he's just, oh yeah, yeah, you know. So you can see it from the beginning a little bit, just enough to be like, something's a little different with this guy, you know? And then, like you said, then it snowballs all the way to the end. And then Shelley Duvall, you know, pretty famously, her and Kubrick, I don't know if you want to say they clashed as much as Kubrick tortured her with like, repeated takes and a bunch of, you know, whatever crazy things he did. I know at one point she started to like actually start having hair fall out, and
he did everything except waterboard her.
Yeah. And, which is, you know, you hear the stories now and you're like, I don't know that you could do that stuff now with like certain actors would be like, it's just his thing and we got to figure it out, you know, but I don't think you could do that now.
Now you just sexually harass him and
right, yeah. Speaking of getting dark, I think Danny Torrance, you know, I think, you know, some of his speaking role, he doesn't speak a whole lot in this one, I guess is what it is, but that intense thing where he's shaking when he's using the shinning, and that's kind of iconic now. It's kind of iconic imagery, him shaking his head and that kind of crazed stare. And so he did a nice job. And I wish we could have gotten more of Scatman Crothers as Halloran. It'd have been nice to get some more of him. Just, he's a captivating actor. You know, Brandon and I just talked about him. He was not much in it, but One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But man, he's like a guy when he's on screen, you're just like, you're like, this guy's cool, man. I just want to like hear this guy talk and see what he wants to do.
Dirty.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I really like what you said about Jack Nicholson's portrayal, about having that little bit of crazy sprinkled in, because of course, when we are looking at this story, we're coming from the perspective of the book first. And then when we're talking about movies, we're usually comparing them to the book. And Jack, and I'm just going to call him John for the sake of simplicity because he's John in the book, are such different men, such different characters. Their motivations are completely different even. And John's sort of someone you see as stable who is descending into madness because of the ghosts and other things happening to him. But with Jack, you have that impression that there's always something there below the surface. Even before they leave, there's problems in the home is what it's alluded to. And he doesn't necessarily have that outside force of these ghosts changing who he is. It's more of an internal thing. And we're kind of seeing that vision through what Kubrick's showing us, which is so cool.
So I got to pop in before we let Brandon take over. It's just the fact that, you know, this is a guy who, not in the book and in the movie, he is an alcoholic, and he has that past trauma of that. So that past trauma, I think, is what's that sprinkled thing that you said, like, you know, some people can be completely over it, or some people are, you know, when they're just, I don't know. But I feel like that is what's causing him to, you know, as he's losing control, he wants the constant that knows that will make him feel better. And that's where we get the spectral spirit serving spirits. I see that, and that's how I interpret that sometimes. But yeah, I mean, just that his gradual descent is just something, it's a performance for the ages. So Brandon, your deep dive when it comes to, acting.
Yeah. As Jay mentioned, he and I just talked about Cuckoo's Nest on a podcast last month. So that was in the back of my mind the whole time while watching this. And it's kind of in Cuckoo's Nest, you see Nicholson go from this unsavory character to a more heroic figure toward the end. And this is the complete opposite, even though there's more menace toward the end. But it really,
range, man, he's good at what he does.
But no, it really, really is. And I was watching some YouTube videos Studios, and I was watching Steven Spielberg, who had a close relationship with Kubrick, right after he saw the movie. He did tell Stanley Kubrick, you know, I did think Nicholson's performance, he might have gone just a little over the top, almost to where it was, he said, Kabuki theater almost. It's almost like, you know, apparently Kubrick said, you know, one of his favorite actors growing up was Cagney, James Cagney, and James Cagney, everything he did was operatic. So he's having Nicholson do everything on an operatic level. This is like the opera of horror films, and everything is so stylized and so over the top that, yeah, he does play it pitch perfect. And I think that it really, it's a performance for the ages because, and I think you're right, Jay. You can see that little bit of menace from the very beginning, and he's keeping a lid on it. But then, of course, as cabin fever, you know, tends to do, it just sort of overtakes you. And then I think Shelley Duvall is fantastic. And I think part of the reason why this movie affected me when I first saw it was, I don't know if any of you all else grew up with Shelley Duvall, Fairy Tale Theater. And they, so to see the woman who, you know, taught me Goldilocks growing up, you know, to see her go through all this kind of stuff, that was a little jarring. But I think she's fantastic. You know, this and Olive Oil and Popeye to me are the two things I think of when I think of Shelley Duvall. But she's really fantastic. And I think that Danny, it's a wonderful, I don't know how you get some of that stuff out of a child actor because they haven't lived life and seen some of those things that, you know, you would draw on as an adult actor. So you would have to really, really be persuasive. And I'm sure Kubrick had persuasive ways of getting things done, but
torture. It's called torture.
But yeah, it's a brilliant child performance. And then, yeah, you're right. You can never get too much of Scatman Crothers in any movie.
Yeah. You know, and I read something in researching all this, where Kubrick was insanely cruel to Shelley Duvall. He was very protective of Danny Lloyd. The scene where she's running around with him, that's actually a doll because he didn't want, you know, him to, you know, see the arguing between the two. So he was very protective. And I think that was genius because you get a more natural approach from Danny. You know, he's just taking everything as it is. He's not witnessing the other actors be cruel. It's just a very fresh take. And I don't know if you guys know this, but the whole finger thing with his imaginary friend, that was the boy. He had said that. Normally he was just supposed to speak as his imaginary friend, but he was the one who did the finger bending. The kid is a genius. Genius. When I was 6 years old, I was wondering what turtle I was going to throw farther, but into his character. So, I mean, just fantastic. I think the unsung hero of this movie, where we have two great lead performances, is Scatman Crothers in this supporting role. I mean, he brings Danny on a whole nother level, just to support Danny. I mean, that is all he supports in this movie. And he does so in such a way that it's fatherly and patriarchal. Whereas this is a guy that's sitting beneath a portrait of a naked lady. You know,
he's so cool.
Right. I just love his performance in this movie. And I love watching. And even when he's getting axe murdered, like just the pain on his face speaks volume. It's not his scream. It's the anguish on his face when he realizes like he's dying. And then, you know, I don't know. It's just fantastic acting all the way around. So, Brandon also mentioned, you know, the way this movie was shot. So let's talk about, you know, some of those key scenes that really stand out to us. I'm going to go first. I'm going to be a jerk. I'm just going to say the opening, the music, and the way that oversee as Jack Torrance is driving to the Overlook, just the scenic beauty. You think you're going to watch a nature documentary instead of something that's just going to be so utterly horrific. You know, Kubrick really has a way of taking the rug out from under you because he makes you feel like you are all at peace until things are not at peace. And that goes to show what type of filmmaker he was and the craft that he does. But just the opening scenes, you know, are so beautiful. And we all know that Kubrick is a controlist. He wants to make sure everything is done his way. But, you know, I wonder how many times he flew over just to make sure he could get the perfect amount of beauty. So, I mean, for me, that's one thing I like, but I'm going to let you guys take the rest. Let's go with Jay.
Yeah. I just to riff off yours too. The music over the top of that too, man. It's absolutely haunting. And I told my wife when it started, I said, this is like one of my favorite parts. This is just the intro. And it's just the camera flying through. But what's great about it is I think it adds to some of the ambiguity of the movie, right? Because in the movie version, are there spirits there? Is this just their madness kicking in? But when it starts like that, it's almost like this haunting, omniscient view of them, well, of Jack driving to the Overlook, flying through the mountains. So I think it just the way it was shot adds to that ambiguity. But I think my very favorite scene is when he's walking up the steps towards Shelley Duvall, towards Wendy, when he's gone, right? Like that's the moment you like 100% know. Cause he goes, I'm not going to hurt you. Listen, I'm not going to hurt you. Just going to bash your bleeping brains in, you know, he's gone over the edge, man. And, honestly, having her be meek and him be so frightening, right then and there, like, that's that buildup. That's where, for me, the buildup kicks in and the goosebumps pop up. And there's all that kind of flash imagery, the blood from the elevator, the girls chopped up with, you know, there's all that flash imagery, which I think builds up the suspense and the horror for you in your mind. But that's the moment for me when it's, I really did. I got goosebumps when he said that line and they just like kind of stayed in place until the very end. So I think that's my favorite scene just because that's the one where it's boom, it's on. I'm there.
Total horror mode.
Yes.
Brandon, what song that sticks out for you?
Oh man, just the design of the Overlook Hotel is what always stands out to me because nothing about it is relaxing. Like there's no nice neutral colors that you can ever like. It's all of these garish primary colors that don't, you know, that don't even seem to go together. And it's just, you can see how somebody would be driven insane living in this place for 5 months because, you know, you're just walking around, you know, even if this place weren't possessed, you know, it wouldn't be a pleasant place to stay in. But in terms of scenes for me, it's those two scenes where Jack Torrance walks into the ballroom and has his conversation with the bartender and then of course walks back in and then goes into his restroom and meets with Grady. You know, those two scenes are, you know, for me, the masterclass of, you know, in terms of both directing and acting, those two scenes, because it's really Nicholson sort of really descending into madness both times.
Awesome. Yeah.
With a couple things on, if I can riff off that real quick, yeah. The design, like the set design, Kubrick had the sets designed so like that the size and scope and where windows were and how hallways and things were designed, like wouldn't actually fit in the building that we see from the exterior. And obviously that's not like something we just know, but it's something our brain looks at. Like you look at that ballroom and you're like, I didn't think the hotel was like that tall, you know, and it's like things like that. And like where the office is actually located, Mr. Ullman's office, there shouldn't be a window. It's actually an interior location in the building. So they do all sorts of cool things with it in addition to the design and those things. But with that bar scene, what stood out to me when I last saw it was when he takes that first sip, how loud the gulp they is so loud, you know, and I think it was very intentional, you know, cause he was that, you know, that was him like, okay, I guess I'm back to drinking again. And you hear that, and I don't know. And for our new friends, you know, I don't drink anymore. You know, I drank a little too much back in the day. So for me too, scenes like that are always a little more impactful, man, that first drink and you hear it go down. And I was like, oh, man, I don't remember that. I don't remember that sound being so like hypnotic and loud. And then like the blood red in the bathroom and the scene with Grady, man, like the colors, you're like, God, that bathroom is so bright.
It looks like a bathroom at Target.
Yeah, they really knew back in 1980.
Hey, four presidents stayed at that hotel, sir.
But also, is there a more iconic carpet?
Thank you. So tell us your guys' favorite scene. I imagine it's going to deal with the carpet. I'm kidding.
Kind of, actually, in a way, because sort of going off of what you were saying about the way that the set is, that makes you on an, you know, almost unconscious level feel disturbed, like something's not quite right. And kind of going along with that too, someone said earlier, and I can't remember which one of you it was now, when we were talking about the acting and everything, that they allow room for, you know, there's just space in the scenes. It's not always something happening or somebody talking. And the way he uses that space is so effective at building all of this tension. So when I think back to kind of the most terrifying moments of this movie for me, it's, you know, when he's making that trip, and I want to call it a descent, but he's not descending anywhere, but it feels like he is, into the room and the door slowly opening, and you're getting the image of this weird looking room with all of these strange colors. And it's almost scarier to walk into that space with him and be on that journey as he's slowly making his way into the bathroom. Not even the woman in the tub and what happens there, because that is just very overtly scary. But just building up to that, you don't want him to go in there and you don't want to go in with him. And I love that. And I love the scene with Danny where he's playing with the trucks and the ball rolls to him. And that's another kind of tense moment where you're like, oh, don't look up, just run the opposite direction of that ball, close your eyes, whatever you have to do. And he doesn't, and you have to live in that moment with him. And I love all those little things about it.
Awesome.
I think for me, it is it's the hedge maze.
Okay, yeah, I was gonna say if you guys didn't mention it, go ahead.
Yeah, so I remember one of the just clear memories I have from watching this for the first time was that moment when Danny stops. And first of all, I freaked out that he was stopping. And then when he starts moving backwards and covering his prints, I turned to my aunt and I went, he can do that? It had never occurred to me. That's a thing that would work. And the whole time, like I'm waiting for, because he's slowly, meticulously moving, I'm waiting for like the grab behind him or something. And then when that doesn't happen, the rest of the movie, I was just on the edge of my seat. Like, how does this, like, what is this going to happen here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and just the way it was shot, just the camera work, nothing short of gripping. You really felt like you were in that maze because it was so, you know, forward and panoramic. Like you're just there, not panoramic, but just, you know, tunnel vision. So, okay. So one thing I want to add, I've got two things. Halloran's death, probably the most suspenseful death I can say that I've seen that is so, it's not scary, but it's so suspenseful because the way it's shot is you having just him walking down this hall with pillars and you're like, what pillar is he going to pop out of? You just know it's going to happen. It's like, which one's it going to be? Which one's it going to be? And you're like, okay, he's making it past the first set. He's making it past the second set. Okay, the last set, it's going to be something else. He's going to be hit somewhere else. And then sure enough, just, oh, and just railroaded with his axe, just blasted. And you're like, oh my God, why did I not? You let your guard down because you're just like, okay, he made it through these pillars where any cliche horror is going to have him jump out and you feel safe for him. And then he just gets it. Now we know that, you know, we'll talk later about differences. But man, that was just such a visceral killing. It was just, and it was just one swing, but it was just so animalistic and just so intense. Another thing that I want to talk about is, or just another scene for me, is the disambiguity of the ending. You know, We end with Jack Torrance frozen to death, but then it cuts back to the ballroom and we get closer and closer on these pictures and we see 1969 and we see a picture of him in front looking just like the Joker, like he's been there all along. And you're like, holy crap. And you just sit there and you think, and as you think, you go down this tunnel and you're like, was he alive? Was he reincarnated? Has he never left? And you never get a straightforward answer. So that ending, just the fact that you're never really settled on an answer is just, you know, it really makes the movie hit that much more after you view it. So yeah, those are mine. Anybody else want to add anything as we're talking?
I'll do a quick correction. It was 1921 because he was definitely in like Easy Rider, so he definitely could have been alive for 1969.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
But with like the hedge maze and really any scenes where there was like a chase happening for a majority of it, you were never behind Jack Torrance. He was walking towards you, and Wendy and Danny were always running away from the camera. And I think that does a subconscious thing to us. Like in the hedge maze part two, when Jack Torrance starts to freak out because he can't find his son, it kind of starts to shift where now we're seeing him walk around. Now we're behind him. So I think there's some interesting camera work there that just subconsciously plants those things. But I have a different take on the Halloran death. That's kind of a problem part of the movie for me, just because like, you have this character and then just immediately the second he shows up to do anything, he's just like completely 100% extinguished from the story.
It's and bullshit.
Like, what? Dirty. Why? What did he even show up for? I mean, I guess he acted as a distraction and I don't disagree like with the sentiment of the thrills of it, the suspense of it, just from a storyline point of view. It just seems so, why?
I think Herbert needed a body.
I was thinking the same thing.
He needed a body.
There needed to be some sort of kill on screen.
Right.
It's a horror movie.
Right. Absolutely. And
I guess that's interesting. I never even thought about it. There's two deaths in this whole movie, but it feels like they keep showing a bunch of dead people, I guess. But that's, I never even thought about it. There's only two kills in this movie.
The rest are just horrific images. Okay. So before, do we have any other scenes or any type of filmmaking that we want to talk about? Okay. Before we get into room 236. Okay. To go off what you said, you have a character who can shine. So shouldn't he have shown that he's about to get an axe to the chest? I mean, I mean, I get it, Jay. I get where you're coming from.
X-Men characters. What is wrong with you?
All right, let's talk about one of the scenes that this scene is, I mean, from Here's Johnny, this movie's got a lot of memorable scenes, things that stick out, but the bathtub scene, somebody take away, go ahead. What are your thoughts?
That's good. This is the first episode where Ryan has asked someone else to talk about a naked lady in a movie. So. I appreciate it, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that is a... You know, the first time we sort of see her, you know, which actually I think is incredibly effective when Danny's in the room and we get a hint and then that's it. And then it cuts away and then, which adds to the ambiguity, right? Adds to the ambiguity of, is it cabin fever making us see these things? Are there spirits? And I like that element in the film, and I know we'll get to that with the book and stuff too. But and then when Jack goes in there, and you're like, oh boy, and then you're like, wait, this is like a young, sexy, naked lady. That is not what we thought was in that, and you know. And then that flip when you're like, oh my god, this is horrifying. But then when he goes back and then lies about it too, Yeah. Right? What was in it? Nothing. Not a thing. Yeah. Nothing was in there. You know, I think that was adds to that snowball that we had mentioned of the buildup of the madness. So yeah, that's an iconic scene that, I mean, everybody knows Room 237, you know. Mm-hmm. I was in a band in high school. The first name we were going to go with was Room 237. Then we became TJ Laser and the Sellouts and, you know, different movie for that name.
Well, before we hop to our forte of our Dairy Public Radio hosts, we need to talk about two more things. One is improvements. Do we think this movie needs any improvements? I mean, Stanley Kubrick, the guy is so narcissistic that he takes 237 shots to get like a 20-second clip. Go ahead.
I do. I think there's absolutely room for improvement.
Where?
Here's what I think. The story?
We're going to let Ben talk about it.
Hey, I know we're going to get into that, but here's what I think. I think this is top five all-time horror classics. I think if the story gets improved, this is on best all-time movie list. I think there's some things that Kubrick didn't think were as important. We talked about that open space, letting things build, which I thought was good. I think 10 to 15 extra minutes of exposition and this movie is now perfect. I really think that's all it has to be. I think some of the changes from the book to the movie that we're going to talk about soon, for the most part, I'm cool with it. But I think there's some of the things from the book, if he'd incorporated it, would have added to the ambiguity that he was going for. And I think he wanted to use visual and audio storytelling to build a mood, not tell a cohesive story.
Okay. Brandon, you're our classics guy.
No. Well, the funny thing is I was going to say, you know, Kubrick to me is always a little long-winded. So I thought maybe they could trim 15 minutes off of it, but maybe replace it with, you know, a little more exposition. And you all, my only experience with The Shining is this movie. So I'm interested in this talk that you all are going to have later on. But the Native American aspect of this has always puzzled me. They don't explain that. They mention that this is over, you know, old Indian burial grounds. But I'm like, does that play into the horror of it? And the movie never really discusses that after that. So
you know, they move the headstones, but they didn't move the bodies.
Right.
Second.
But
that's not.
But yeah. And then the other thing, and this really isn't an improvement, but we didn't talk about it. The guy in the bear suit, I always forget is there, and it always takes me off guard when I see
it. This is the thing I was trying to forget.
Yeah.
My husband has a t-shirt of that, the guy in the bear suit on the bed, but it has a heart around it. So it's like this Valentine's Day kind of romantic thing. And it has changed that scene for me. Yeah.
It is
the untold love story of the movie.
Your husband's shirt is a kiss game.
They're so in love, they forgot to shut the door while performing fellatio. That's good. You know, that's true love.
Can I ask you guys a question before we kind of move on to that next piece?
Yeah.
When you were talking about the bathtub scene, so I'm horror obsessed, but at the same time, I have a very visceral response to horror, and I don't know if you guys have this too. I assume everybody has it, but whenever I see that, and he's got his hands on her, and he's touching like those sores. Ooh. My hands and body just start tingling, and it's a very unpleasant and uncomfortable feeling. Is that – do you guys
feel
for that naked lady?
He's embracing a beautiful lady, and then he looks in the mirror and realized, oh, crap.
Well, that's what you get for cheating on your wife, honestly.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you want to shake off the gross, though.
Like, yeah.
Like, I think everybody does this. I think I saw everybody. Like,
right. Okay.
Wendy just smelled his hands when he came back.
Okay.
Well, somebody had to make it weird.
Broken up.
<It's good. I'm> Okay, Impact. Last thing we need to talk about, what makes it a classic. I mean, Josh, you already brought up Treehouse of Horror. You know, they spoofed it with The Shining. You know, we've got Toy Story has the carpet, the same carpet as the hallways. You know, Here's Johnny and Red Rum. Is there anything else I'm missing? I mean, this movie, 40 years old, and it is still relevant now. I mean, Jay just went to go see it on Saturday. The movie is still relevant. What other impact do you guys think it has on pop culture?
You know, I'd say with Here's Johnny, it feels like that was Johnny Carson's thing.
Right.
I don't think that's what people that didn't grow up on Johnny Carson think it's from now.
Right.
I think they think it's from The Shining. So I think that's pretty amazing. He took the most popular late night talk show host of all time, took his little intro from his show, and now it like belongs to this movie. So I think that alone speaks to the volumes of impact that this movie
Dairy has. Public Radio. Josh, what do you think about the impact?
Well, without this movie, we wouldn't have the frozen Jack Nicholson meme that you can just post in comments. That anytime, it's one of the most, like we talked about Treehouse of Horrors, yeah, but it's like those scenes that get spoofed. Being frozen solid, making that face is spoofed in so many things.
Right. Oh, Sam, yeah. What do you think?
This is going to be more of a general response, but I think overall what this film and just his style in general has done specifically for horror filmmaking, and I love all kinds of horror films, you know, the silly ones, the funny ones, the terrifying ones, but kind of moving us away from almost slapstick horror sometimes or more like cheap scares. And again, it's that tension and all the care and thought he put into even just all of those subliminal type things and messages. That every time I see the scene where Danny's watching TV and I realize again, and I have to realize this every time, that there's no cord to the TV. It's not plugged in. Just all those little details that are so off-putting. It's like just the way he lovingly cared for all of those things, I think has definitely changed horror movies moving forward from that point.
Awesome. That's, I mean, I completely forgot about the TV not being plugged in. So completely relevant. Awesome. Brandon, thoughts on impact?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned before, you know, I think nobody had really seen the horror genre done this artfully before on a mainstream level. So I think it did it for that. But also I think without Jack Nicholson's performance as Jack Torrance, you don't have Jack Nicholson as the Joker. You don't have him in Witches of Eastwick. I think this sort of sent him on a totally different trajectory in his career. He was this sort of gritty actor in these, you know, very, you know, artfully done 70s films. And this sort of showed America that, yeah, Jack Nicholson can be creepy and we're going to capitalize on that, which, you know, he did for over a decade after that.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, it's just, I mean, when you talk horror, The Shining will be brought up in one way, shape or form.
You know, what's interesting is talking about how artfully, you know, the movie was done, which I totally agree. I mean, it's an artsy film, man. But to me, it seems like there was a weird shift right about the year this movie came out in the style of horror. To me, it seems like it was almost the tail end. Although I think we're having a resurgence now. I feel like it was like the tail end. You had like Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, The Omen, and you had this kind of slew for about 15 years. And it seems like The Shining was like kind of the peak of the artistic take on it. And then 1980, I'm convinced it's because of Evil Dead, but people may disagree, is when horror took a turn and it was a little more, campy, a little more funny. So it's interesting to me where like it hits on 1980. And it just seems like, boom, horror did change. But now I think we're seeing a bunch of filmmakers. I'm thinking especially like Ari Aster and the dude that did The Witch. I always forget his name. And Jordan Peele and those guys were getting this very artistic mainstream horror coming back. And I, I absolutely think this movie's, it's got to be an influence, just some of the shots. You know, one shot we didn't mention, and it's in Twister, so I'll use that for my impact. You know, they're at the drive-in theater.
Okay.
By the way, Twister coming, you know, and as he's swinging the axe, the screen starts ripping up. But the way they shot him swinging that axe and the camera would move with him as he, oh my God. Like those yeah. are the coolest. It is not an action scene, but it feels like you're like there heaving that axe with him.
Nicholson was an auxiliary fireman or firefighter. And so he knew how to swing an axe. So the first couple doors they made, they made him flimsy because it takes like, you know, him a couple whacks. He took the door down in one.
Like, stop saving lives, dude.
He just really wanted to get to her. All right. So there's no doubt in our mind that this movie is huge when it comes to the game of horror. But now let's move on to you know, the differences, because this movie is vastly different than its source material. And that's why we asked our friends from Dairy Public Radio to hop on just to lead us. This is where I learned. So, but Stephen King has been noted to say, you know, he thought the movie was very visually stunning, but he said that there was no substance, and he compared it to a fancy car without an engine, which I okay. So let's take that deep dive. Let's talk about, you know, and Jay, you had mentioned this, and Jay, you just got done reading it. But let's talk about book versus movie. So this is where I throw everything at Dairy Public Radio. Run with it. Teach me.
Fantastic. I will say, so like we talked about earlier, when we do things on our show, we treat the adaptations specifically as they come from the book. And when you take The Shining on its own, I do kind of agree with Stephen King's assessment of it. It's like, I love watching The Shining. I think some of it's kind of dumb. Like, some, like I hate the ending. The ending's the worst thing in the world to me. I hate it so much. Hold on. But I lost my train of thought. Sorry.
Do you want me to skillfully interrupt?
Yeah. Perfect.
Retrain him.
I'm not the good one at segues.
Oh, sorry. I remember what I was going to say.
Shit.
Yeah. Segwayed.
Yeah, segwayed. It worked. It's that by itself, yes, it is fun to watch, but when you compare it, it's just one of the worst adaptations if you're talking directly from source material. I think it lacks a lot of things that the book brings forward.
Okay. I have kind of a weirdly different take on that. Well, okay, probably not weird to anyone who's ever heard our show, because I will forgive anything Stephen King, even if it's not really Stephen King. I won't be critical, because I'm just like, I love it too much. But normally when I watch an adaptation, especially if it's the source material, something that's very dear to my heart, and of course we're talking books, and especially Stephen King, that's always going to be very dear to my heart. I want to see that book come to life, so I'm going to have trouble if it deviates too much. But I've kind of learned that I have to really make a conscious effort to remove myself from the book and view the movie as its own thing. And for me, The Shining works really well because I think of it more of a tribute than an adaptation. It's kind of its own creature. And I'm okay with it, because if you're going to change key things, you have to do it in the most fantastic, graceful, disturbing way you possibly can. And I feel like The Shining pulls that off. So you either make it exactly the way I envision it in my head somehow, or you wow me. And the thing that we love about books is you can reread them. You can reread them every few years and get something different out of that. It's really hard to get that out of an adaptation. You lose something. But with The Shining, you can rewatch that over and over, over the years, and get something new out of it each time.
Awesome. So Josh, you talked about the ending. Let's just talk about that, because the ending.
Yes, please.
In Kubrick's versus the ending in the miniseries did it right. So I'll let you.
Yes. Go. God. And that's why, honestly, if you tell me you have to watch The Shining, and you can either watch the miniseries or the movie. I'm picking miniseries every time. I love the miniseries.
It's good.
It's so much fun. So the things that I wish had been different, they don't kill Dick Halloran in the book. He just gets whacked with a roque mallet. And he's integral in the rescue. And following that character, if we could have seen the movie Dick Halloran doing as much as he does in the book, we'd get more out of his arrival to the rescue, because his whole arc is doing everything he can. He pushes himself to the point of almost crashing his car in a blizzard to get up there and rescue them. And then he gets to be the hero. That's what you want from that kind of story arc. You want him to come in and help rescue them. You don't want to see him show up and get axed.
Right. I mean, it's almost like you're throwing away Scatman Carruthers.
Exactly. Who wants to throw away Scatman Carruthers?
Right.
But the most important thing, which is the reason the ending to the miniseries is, in my opinion, so much better, is that you give Jack Torrance a redeeming moment.
Yes.
It is the whole point is the reason they need to be there. That boiler, it always comes back to that. And when he remembers that the boiler hasn't been dumped, and he has a choice to kill his family or save them by making sure it doesn't, like, either destroying the hotel or destroying his family. One of the two. And he finally chooses his family.
Yeah, I mean,
and I think that's, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, go ahead.
Oh, I think that's the major thing that's missing from the Kubrick film, is the entire time you watch the Kubrick film, you are never rooting for Jack. There's not a single time you root for him. When you read the book and you watch the miniseries, he shows enough that you really hope he can bring it back around for his family, because they really do love each other. They do work out it's not a perfect family by any means. They've been through the stuff, but you want to see them make it through this. And you just don't get that with the Kubrick film, I think.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you brought up the redemptive, because that the redemptive story arc, because that really sets the tone for Dr. Sleep. I have not read Dr. Sleep, but we'll talk about that here in a second. But I mean, it's almost like if I could mesh Kubrick and the miniseries together, it'd be perfect. Brandon and Jay, are you guys familiar with the miniseries?
I don't remember, but I got some thoughts on the book and the movie. Okay.
Go ahead.
And with the ending, I actually disagree. I actually really like the ending, because I think it fits with the narrative of the movie, of ambiguity, not that clean. He is making that change. We do have a clear-cut ending. We know how it ends. So I actually do like the film ending for the film. I like the book ending in the book, but I was a fan of that change. I guess I wanted to ask you guys what your thoughts are on, you know, the book. The supernatural elements are clear cut. There are ghosts in this hotel. It is not their imagination. In fact, there's a scene where, you know, Jack even starts to kind of morph into something, some creature, you know. It's hard for me to even imagine what it was, because I'd seen the movie first. But what are your guys' thoughts on the leaving the supernatural elements a little more ambiguous?
Tamed.
I think that I really want to forgive it for that, because I feel like maybe that ambiguity and like I said earlier, that really changes these two characters from book to movie, and even miniseries / book to movie, mm-hmm. since the miniseries and the book are so much more similar. But that ambiguity, shit, what was I going to say? Now
I've rubbed off on you. Yeah. Off.
Quick segue.
Sorry, my husband's also playing bass, and like, can they hear that?
And so, no, wait, I can't.
Okay, good.
Do you want me to jump in and let it come back to you?
Yeah.
All right. I think the ambiguity in my opinion, is a disservice. Because I'm a horror fan of, I like to know my horror. I'm a real rules junkie when it comes to horror. So I notoriously don't like haunting things, because hauntings, the rules just change on a whim. And it's like, I was going to say, the lady in the bathtub in the movie is the first time I ever saw the thing that I hate the most in every other movie, which is... scary ghost slowly moves, but you know they're never actually, like, they'll get close, but they'll never actually touch them.
I forgot Josh hates ghosts.
I hate ghosts.
And I think the ambiguity actually is better served on film than it is in the book. I think in the book, having the ghosts as that driving force and as something more visceral, you know, more tangible, works really great on paper. But translating that into a movie, maybe that was the best way to go, to make that more of a psychological internal process. So I'm okay with it either way, honestly. I just enjoy this story kind of in all of its mediums.
Yeah.
I only think...
Oh, sorry. Keep going, Josh.
Oh, I only think that the... Well, I agree with what you're saying, that in a film adaptation, giving that sense of cabin fever is a fun route to take. The problem is that, for me at least, that had never been possible for me. I never believed, I've never been able to see this movie as a possible cabin fever scenario, because they all have shared, like, there are times they have shared hallucinations. They're seeing the same things. They're reacting to the same things. That I can't, there's no part of me that can say, oh, this is hallucinations, everyone's just having these, there's no ghosts at all. There's just too much in there to make me able to see it otherwise.
It's a collective subconscious, man.
Sorry, Ryan.
Go ahead, Jack.
I like ambiguity in my horror. Because I think it teaches us something about ourselves, and it's usually that we're more screwed up in the head than we've maybe given ourselves credit for, because usually what we're imagining and the direction we take things is usually far worse than anything a director can come up with. So I like that. I think it takes our minds places that's sometimes surprising, and I like it. I like making viewers make a choice in how they view something and how they take it. But I totally agree with Sam. I think it would have been weird in the book. It would have been weird to have it ambiguous. I think it worked. But the thing I missed the most that I think could have made the ambiguity stronger, you mentioned the family. There's a lot of story with the family, and his alcoholism and anger management issues are front and center. And I don't think it would have taken a lot. Like I said, trim 10 or 15 minutes of some of those panning shots. And build exposition in there. And I think, man, if you know we know he's an alcoholic, sort of. We don't know that he got fired from his last job for beating a kid up. Yeah. You know what I mean? That makes it a little bit more ambiguous. That's what happens in the book. We know he's an alcoholic. We didn't know he got drunk with his rich friend, ran over a bike and thought he killed a guy or a kid. Didn't kill anybody, but it haunts him. You throw a couple of those things in there, I legitimately think this movie is an all-time, not just horror, but an all-time great, because it builds the ambiguity. Like, oh, this dude really is messed up.
I agree with that, because it's one of those things where in the book, you know that, you know, he's got all these past issues, his past trauma, and that plays into his madness as he experiences cabin fever, whereas in the movie, you just see him being bored, bouncing a ball off the wall, trying to get an idea. And his is just completely, you know, exterior instead of interior. You know, it's just said that he's got anger issues and he's an alcoholic. That's it. That's how they left it. And then from there, it's the hotel that does it. Whereas in the book, it's all those past occurrences. And then you go and it just messes with him. So...
What are ghosts? I mean, I don't think
I'm
ghost,
sorry. What?
I don't think
he heard you.
As I don't think of ghosts as, you know, disembodied, restless spirits. I think of ghosts as us all being haunted by our pasts, by decisions that we've made, by things that have happened to us, and by our own personal demons. You know, we've dealt with addiction in my family as well. And I think that in and of itself, too, is a kind of ghost.
Yeah.
I think that's captured better on film. But I mean, I do agree to a point. I miss those other more overt things that are just better on paper.
Yeah. Okay, so I've seen the miniseries. The miniseries was made in 97. It's got Steven Weber as Jack Torrance, Rebecca De Mornay as Wendy, Cortland Mead, I think his name was. I don't know, but he played Danny. And then you have Mario Van Peebles' father, Melvin Van Peebles, playing Doc Halloran. So that one is definitely very true to the book because it is written by Stephen King, because in the 90s, there's just this huge resurgence of TV miniseries by Stephen King. You have Rose Red, Storm of the Century, and then of course the Shining. So, you know, he made the script the way he wanted it. But I have a question for you guys, cause I have not read the book. Is the scene with the lawn sculptures, is that in the book?
Yeah, the topiary. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why did Kubrick not do that? That could have been so not art. Like, come on.
No feasible way to pay for that in 1980.
Yeah. Yeah. Kubrick would have found a way. I mean, dude,
it would have looked awful.
So? It would have looked. It would not have aged well.
Yeah, there's just the risk of that not coming across. Like, I'm afraid we would have laughed at it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad he went with the maze. The maze was a really good, also just creepy and off-putting representation of that.
Yeah, I mean, I laughed at the imagery in 1997, so it didn't make a difference. All right, is there anything else that we want to talk about when it comes to book versus movie before we move into sequel talk and ranking our movies? Anything else?
I'm good.
All right.
Am I in trouble if I haven't seen Dr. Sleep?
No.
Nope. Am I going to be sad that it's about to be spoiled for
we're
me?
Not gonna,
we don't have to spoil it.
We're not reviewing this movie. So just recently we had a film come out with Ewan McGregor and what is her name? Who plays Rosie the Hat?
Keep talking. I'll look it up because I can't remember
her
name.
But it was directed by the great Mike. Who was it?
Something Ferguson.
Rebecca Ferguson. Rebecca Ferguson. And then you've got, it was directed and written by Mike Flanagan. Mike Flanagan, you may know him from The Haunting of Hill House and The Haunting of Bly Manor, but this guy knows how to do horror. It's fantastic. So we're not going to spoil it, but I think the director's cut, you guys, those who have seen it, I think the director's cut is better than the original cut. But let's just talk sequel rankings. So Doctor Strange is the story of
Doctor Strange. Where are you taking us?
Doctor Sleep
enters the MCU. Did you not stay in the post credit scene?
Sorry, the multiverse of madness involves The Shining.
Benedict Cumberbatch. Ben's time.
Well, now I have to see.
Movie's over. Marvel Cinematic Universe. That was
speaking of. There's more impact. Ready Player One. There's a whole scene from The Shining in there.
Yeah,
forgot about that too.
Okay, so Dr. Sleep is a continuing story of Danny and his struggles. You know, is he following in his father's footsteps? He meets a girl who shares the same gift, and he almost becomes the new Doc Halloran. So let's talk movies and rankings. We're going to rank the original Shining. We're going to rank the miniseries, and we're going to rank Dr. Sleep. But I'm going to allow for even one more, and you can even rank the director's cut. So you have four movies that you can rank. If you haven't seen them, you can just have them be down below. I'll go first. So mine at the lowest bottom is just the original, the Shining miniseries. It's good. It tells the story that Stephen King wanted to tell, but it's so hokey. It's so cheesy. The makeup is awful, but still it tells the story, but you can't tell the story, that the real story, without being on screen. Next, you have Dr. Sleep, regular, the rated, the rated version. Then you've got the uncut version, because that just movie is so much better. Rosie the Hat is by far one of the best villains in a Stephen King story. She is just menacing, and Rebecca Ferguson breathes so much life into her. And then, of course, you have The Shining. Shining is the best. You're not going to top it. You talk about it every time you talk Halloween. And I think Dr. Sleep isn't really a horror movie. It's more of that drama side. So, The Shining all the way. So let's go with our residents at Dairy Public Radio. How would you guys rank the sequels when it comes to the movies?
I feel like we should rank them the way we rank our.
Yeah. So on our show, we rank things on 1 out of 5 blue chambray shirts.
That's what Stephen King writes about all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
Blue shirts.
if I can ask for a clarification, are we talking about objectively best to worst, or personally, if we were to sit down and watch it
personally?
Oh God. Sorry guys. If it's me, if I'm going to pick one of these to watch, last one I'm watching is The Shining. The middle one I'm watching is the miniseries, and I'm watching Dr. Sleep a million times.
Now the uncut version.
I saw it in theaters twice and then got the uncut version and watched it immediately because I loved
it. It's so much better. It's so much better.
It's great. And it without spoiling it, it perfectly ties the universe together of book and movie on all four counts. And just that made me, as a King fan, it made me so satisfied to see things come around that way that I could not talk enough great stuff about that movie.
Okay. CM, what do you think?
I haven't seen Dr. Sleep, but I can say that I would give The Shining 5 out of 5 blue chambray shirts.
Of course.
Josh is judging me. I would also, I'd have to give the mini series 5 out of 5 blue chambray shirts.
Yeah.
And although I haven't seen Dr. Sleep yet, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to give it 5 out of 5.
Whole new pop. Man, you're swinging for the fences.
I think there's some Stephen King love bias going on here.
Everything ties for first place for Stephen.
Stephen King, 5 out of 5. Kubrick did it, 5 out of 5. All right, that's awesome. Brandon, what do you think?
Well, I've only seen the Kubrick film, so I can tell you where it ranks in terms of my list of Kubrick films. Somewhere between Dr. Strangelove and Full Metal Jacket, probably. No.
Okay. All right, Jay, what do you think?
I got to go with the same order as you. I will say I really don't remember the miniseries much. I remember...
Not much to remember.
Yeah, I remember it-ish. I don't have much memory of it. But the just yesterday finished the watching the extended version of Dr. Sleep. And see, I got to wait till my wife falls asleep because she doesn't do horror. So and so I started watching the Trial of the Seven. Chicago 7. And then I was like, oh, now I don't want to turn this off. So then I had to like force myself to turn it off to watch it. 3 hours long, extended edition. It's not it's a half an hour of extra stuff. Like it's an extended edition. I mean, it's not Lord of the Rings, Holy Grail extended edition,
but it's 4 endings later.
Hey, I'll take every one of them. You can give me 6 more. But, to not ruin it, I got to say, I actually think Dr. Sleep for me does just what Josh said. It ties everything together, really does merge them. But I actually think it makes The Shining a better movie. I think if you watch these as 2 movies together, The Shining is better because of Dr. Sleep. I think it fills in those emotional gaps that we're missing. And it does it very well, and while paying homage to elements of the book and homage to elements of the film, man, is it good? Oh man. But I gotta say, the ending of that movie, I absolutely love the ending of that movie. I think it's so awesome what they do, because I have no idea how the book ends. I haven't read Dr. Sleep. I've got to share this with you. The Shining is the first Stephen King book I've ever read, and I just read it a few weeks ago. For this episode.
Good start. It's a good one to start with.
I have no clue why I haven't read more,
but Dr. Sleep, because it's different and great.
Okay. I'm very excited because I love movies. I think Rose the Hat, man, not just a great bad guy. I mean, I think one of the best in the last 20 years.
Agreed.
100%. I really think she's one of the best villains we've had on film in at least the last two decades. She's a full character. Yeah. She has motivations. She has a philosophy. She's not just a bad guy, you know, and she's amazing. But I still got to go with the original. Got to go with the original. Just as a piece of cinema, the way he uses the camera, the way he uses sound, the way he uses music, set design, framing, like even without story, that movie makes you feel a certain way. Yeah. Like you don't even need a story. This, you could have no dialogue and you'd still feel the same way at the end of that movie. And I think that's, man, is that a skill? Like I said, I think some things could have been done just a little better, but I don't know where that falls in my top Kubrick movies though. Now I got to think about that, Brian. Well, we can talk about that next month.
We're talking about Kubrick next month. Yeah.
Yeah. So miniseries, Dr. Sleep, Extended Shining. Same as you, Ryan.
Just think though, if we did not get this movie from Kubrick and he did not do it the way he wanted to, we would have gotten the 1997 miniseries, and we all would have been. So thank you, Mr. Kubrick. May you rest in peace. Oh, man. Okay, before we wrap it up, is there anything else that we want to address? Speak now or forever hold your peace. All right. Thank you. I want to send out a huge thank you to our friends over at Dairy Public Radio. Thank you so much for coming on. Right now, I want you guys to do your shameless plug. What do you guys got coming up? What episode you guys are releasing? And of course, where can we hear you at?
So we are currently releasing episodes on the book Needful Things, and we are having a blast reading this book. It is amazing. So you can find those episodes everywhere you listen to podcasts. We also have a Patreon page where we try our very, very best to give our members lots of rewards and perks and merchandise, and we release episodes early there, and we also do bonus episodes. We play RPG games. The one we just did is Kids on Bikes, and we kind of gave it a bit of a Stephen King twist. So if you're interested in more of our stuff, you can find us there. And then, of course, Facebook, Twitter, at Dairy Public Radio, and can email us at dairypublicradio@gmail.com. We love getting emails from people, and we always respond.
Jay, were you paying attention? If you want to read more, I mean, they're reading them to you. So, all right.
Pretty much, yeah.
Thank you guys again so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yep. Brandon, thank you so much for telling. Yeah. I mean, great idea to do a crossover like this. What have you got coming up for the next couple months?
Well, we just released our episode on the original Frankenstein from 1931 last month. And then depending on when this releases, I think you'll be able to hear our feed only episode, which is going to be Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. So we get to go the horror comedy route. And that's a fun episode. And then next month, Jay and Aaron are going to join Eric and I, and we're going to talk about Kubrick again. We're going to talk about Spartacus, a movie that he was less proud of, I think, but a lot of people like more than he does, actually. And then we're also going to do a poll at the end of November, and we're going to let the listeners decide. We're going to do four options from the film noir genre, and we're going to talk about a film noir next month.
Awesome. Thank you. Jay, what do we got coming up for flashbacks?
All right. So in October, we still have a little bit of time left on Front Row Flashbacks. Our last monster cast for the Halloween season is going to be The Craft, 1996,
yeah.
Hopefully. 1990s grunge, apathy-filled witch movie. And we're going to be tying it in, doing something on The Craft Legacy, I think a two-in-one kind of episode there. So there's the new Craft Legacy coming out, and we're gonna flash back to the original and talk, see how it compares to the new one. And then I just want to throw this one out there because I'm very excited. Myself and Convince Me host Larry Smith, we're going to be working on a side project with Flashbacks Presents Cobra Kai. And I'm sure Ryan will probably be joining us a lot on that one too. We're gonna kind of speed through up season one in November, season two in December, and then season three starts on Netflix in January. So we're gonna start there doing every single episode, and we're excited. Karate Kid, obviously, something we haven't got to yet, but it's on the Flashbacks radar. So we're gonna flashback to that. Then I'd encourage everybody to follow us, Front Row Flashbacks and Front Row Classics, on whatever medium you listen to your podcast. And you can join the Front Row Flashbacks podcast group on Facebook and continue this discussion beyond us just talking here. But one thing, I apologize to anybody that is on there. I have been slacking on getting some stuff uploaded to there, so I'll make sure I start getting some things up there.
Erin's not here. We'll blame her.
Yeah, yeah. Ryan, when was the last time you posted there?
Erin's home. School started, man. I'm busy. You forgot to mention November. That's like the one thing I'm looking forward to. November, we are going, just because we like to stay in tune with things at Flashbacks, we're going to be looking at the American president. Why not in the time of a presidential election? So just make sure you follow not only us, but Dairy Public Radio and the Classics channel. You can find us, on NPR Illinois website under Community Voices tab. You can follow us on Twitter, the Front Row Reviews with a Z. You can also find us on our Patreon at the Front Row Network's Facebook page. So if you enjoyed this content, if there's anything, you would like, or even be on an episode, just become a full-time Patreon. Before we sign off, I just want to say thank you again to Dairy Public Radio. You guys rocked it. I can't wait to do more collabs with you. If you guys are up to it, if you guys just want to get rid of us, just let us know.
Yeah, we'd be happy to come back and chat with you guys.
CM, Josh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Brandon from Front Row Classics, thank you very much.
Yeah.
This has been a flashback. I've been your host, Ryan, and with me, of course, has been
Jay.
Thank you very much, everybody, and we will see you in the front row.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more from the Front Row Network, including our articles or our other dozens of shows, visit thefrontrownetwork.com or nprillinois.org/programs/frontrownetwork. You can also find us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, and on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z.